Welcome to a new episode of Becoming a Post-Growth Planner, Obstacles and Challenges to Changing Roles and Practices. My name is Christian Amker, Assistant Professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And today, my special welcome goes to Matthias Kranke and Malcolm Campbell-Verdaun. It's special for two reasons, because our biographies connect us between Groningen and the Ruhr region in Germany, and both of you hosted a workshop exploring post-growth infrastructures in Groningen a week ago. That's then on 13th March 2026, connected to a special issue in the interdisciplinary journal Economy and Society.
Yeah, thanks, Christian. Thanks for having us. I'm Matt from Matthias. I'm a junior professor for global sustainability governance, and this is a long affiliation of the College of Social Sciences and Humanities of the University of Alliance Ruhr and the University of Duisburg Essen-Wehningen. I work at the intersection of international relations, international political economy, but also draw on other disciplines and such as sustainability studies and ecology at the moment. And my interests are far-reaching, but global governance, international organizations, and sustainability are probably the ones I should mention. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'm Malcolm Campbell-Verdaun. I'm an associate professor, political economist, working in the Department of International Relations, International Organization, the Faculty of Arts at the University of Groningen. I'm an international political economist, and so is Matt. So that's like kind of our shared networks right there. And we previously connected on some special issue work on anticipatory governance a few years ago, which is pretty relevant to the current work that we've been doing on infrastructures and how they evolve in unexpected paths and directions. We also had a volume out recently on bad or ineffective policy, which had a chapter by Matt on growth in Germany. So kind of nice complementarity between our work on growth, post-growth, and myself on infrastructures, especially financial infrastructures.
So then let's move into growth, post-growth, and infrastructures first. Infrastructures regularly seem to be emblematic for growth, the foundations for the GDP to grow. But why do you regard it as crucial to speak about infrastructures and post-growth together?
Yeah, our argument is really that you can't get beyond growth without really getting inside of it, quite literally. So the argument that we're proposing is really that the socio-material foundations of how growth works or doesn't work in some cases, but how it gets promoted, reproduced, extended, really needs to take what I've also called another work on finance, an infrastructural gaze. And that gaze needs to combine two elements. So the infra part, which is the agents, the people, the practices, the objects, so the technical objects, stuff that often gets backgrounded or taken for granted. And that needs to be really connected with structure and the kind of agent and structure dimension that most social scientists would be familiar with. But then to look at these kind of interactions in the sense of a lot of activity is intentional, but there's also kind of unintentional parameters to human activities that, especially planners have some control over it, but that's always within limits. So there's sometimes some structural limits to what we do. For instance, with the policy cycle, you can set agendas, you can formulate policies, but you don't always have complete control about how those policies get enacted. And we think that, infrastructures have a big emphasis on this, to the extent that you could say that they have, agency of their own.
Yeah, I read into your work and I see that you want to address, I quote, the infrastructural foundations of society, which you see crucial to succeed and for post-growth projects to unfold their own transformative potential. Can you briefly explain what is your core argument that underlies your approach, your thoughts to post-growth infrastructures?
Yeah, that change is really hard to enact. Huh? We all know this quite well, especially at scale. Sure, you can have some local changes. How do you do that at the kind of regional level, national level, international level? So at least from my previous research in finance and current kind of research on knowledge infrastructure, it's been really important to kind of get into the nitty gritty of how both kind of small and big changes get enacted in the relations between people and things. And here I should note, that we're really drawing on science and technology studies understandings of infrastructure. And they kind of alert us to this classic notion that matter literally matters at the scale that we want to kind of have to enact change. And especially in cases where we've got to kind of repurpose that matter towards different goals. So post-growth goals.
If I may add, in the process of working on this, we developed this idea or kind of got to the insight that it's interesting to observe that post-growth literature very often speaks about policies, sometimes also about institutions like the welfare state, but rarely tackles, with some exceptions, infrastructural questions. And for us, that was interesting to know because infrastructure is so sticky and a lot of literature is concerned about how you can change policies. There are these wish lists of policy changes that post-growth want to see. But are these really possible? Can these really be enacted without infrastructural change? So in a sense, we're arguing you need to dig into materiality, literally speaking, to better understand where transformations can go well and where they can go wrong and what roadblocks are on the way.
We are already moving into work that you did also on the special issue in Economy and Society, recently published in 2025. That includes 8 articles and an own editorial by yourself. So quite some work to put that all together. Can you take us into the initial idea for that special issue? What made you actually go that way and say we really put together a full special issue on your ideas?
I think the idea of a special issue was appealing because we wanted to show that growth infrastructures are pervasive. And so you could write a single paper on them, but you wouldn't really capture the whole breadth of their existence and the ways in which they work. So for this, it was necessary to really engage with more people, involve more people. But also, I think, and this is what the title of the special issue hints at with the parentheses, post and parentheses, the possibility of other infrastructures, different infrastructures. And while this might not come out in all the articles, I think at least there's some pointers towards this and towards broadening the discussion of what would be needed to work with different infrastructures.
Yeah, the initial idea was really to kind of tackle the elephant in the room of a lot of the interdisciplinary debates on infrastructure that weren't addressing growth, and to say, like, look, we really need to inject growth in this growing literature, quite literally. On the other hand, we wanted to inject some infrastructural thinking into post-growth debates. So really to kind of simply connect infrastructure and post-growth debates. And real practically, we started at a workshop in Amsterdam as part of the European International Studies Association a few years ago. We had this open call for contributors and solicited contributions from colleagues. But broadly, we're working on what we've ended up calling growth infrastructures without necessarily calling it that way. And then, we solicited journals to find a kind of home for the initial outputs and landed in a special issue competition with Economy and Society. And big shout out to the editorial team there, and especially Paul Langley, that also helped fund a second contributor workshop, along with the Rudolf Agricola School for Sustainable Development at the University of Groningen, where we had another workshop in 2024 that included actually the person who coined the term growth infrastructure, Preeti Sampat, a colleague from India, who was a part of that workshop as well.
You really cross along a number of contexts, countries all around the globe. And when I looked into the special issue, I saw articles from Brazil, the Balkans, connections to India, you've mentioned, the Netherlands, Germany. So we look all across the place. But how important is local and national context then really also for talking about post-growth infrastructures, or what also unites all these diverse contexts?
Yeah, it's super important. Our main thrust was that these are infrastructures that are grounded in particular spaces and places. But we also didn't want to kind of feature, you know, the usual suspects. We wanted to go to some kind of under-researched areas and kind of zoom in on what's going on there, draw out some commonalities and put them in conversation with one another to show that, you know, they're all dealing with this notion of kind of relations between the social, the material, but in different settings. We were really fortunate to have reviewers and other commentators at various conferences where we presented this work, really pushing us to be more explicit about foregrounding capitalism broadly as the kind of key connector between all these different spaces and places. And we know, of course, that, you know, capitalism is quite varied, and that we think that focusing on infrastructures allows us to understand both kind of divergences across contexts while still highlighting similarities.
Yeah, we also have Turkey in the mix, just Seba, also a nice paper in there. But yeah, local context matters, but for someone who has a very global view on stuff, on empirics and cases, I would say, while they're actually quite distinct infrastructures that the different papers look at, a common theme is that they have been designed or are easily bent towards the facilitation of what Malcolm and I often jokingly call, somewhat jokingly call, evermore. So we see that in a number of cases that these infrastructures, and we also speak about this in a second in our own paper, how they can become churned towards something else than what they originally were designed for. And importantly, I think also there are connections that reach beyond the local, even the national context, between different infrastructure. And this is something that future work by us or others could really pick up on, something that became clear also during the workshop last week, that there's something to be said about how these different infrastructures are connected to each other and how they interact, something we haven't explicitly traced in this collection, but this is something future work would really work on.
You also had an own article in that special issue that moves to, I would say, one of the least understood recent developments for infrastructures. I quote, post-growth tokens or token post-growth, Bitcoin, altcoins, and infrastructural evolution in digital finance. So not the most immediate thought when thinking about infrastructure from a planning perspective, but certainly underlying a lot of what happens all around us. Can you take us into the key argument and how, I quote again, what was originally designed as a post-growth infrastructure largely, albeit not fully, succumbed to a conventional growth dynamics over a fairly short period?
Yeah, this article is really meant to provoke post-growthers to examine two things. So first is how the kind of seeds of post-growth can be located in unexpected or unusual places, right? Like we wouldn't immediately think of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies or crypto coins as a place for fruitful post-growth debates. But we argue that actually at the origins of Bitcoin, there were some seeds of post-growth thinking, at least. And then the second thing is really how that thinking and acting evolves in, you know, more or less unexpected directions, some of which we could say, like, in hindsight, of course, you know, crypto was going to boom and it was going to go beyond the original kind of limits to growth that got a little bit enacted in Bitcoin with the 21 million tokens. But what especially the kind of influence from science and technology studies alerts us to is this kind of unanticipadedness that is obviously easy in retrospect to pinpoint to. But when we kind of unpack and go back to the kind of origins of a project like Bitcoin, we can see some different parts of a project that actually might give us some insight on how we can look in unexpected places for the seeds of post-growth thinking and acting.
I'll be careful here because Malcolm is the pundit on this, although you shouldn't ask him for investment advice on altcoin. But yeah, Malcolm has drawn me into this world a little bit, and I was skeptical at first when he told me about, okay, Bitcoin being post-growthy, and I was a bit skeptical. But as we worked through this, it was interesting for me to observe this, also how my understanding of this interconnection grew. And I think we eventually landed on making a kind of looking at two principles, I would say, that are representative of post-growth thinking in certain ways. And one is self-limitation, often, of course, in very different contexts. But the idea of collectively agreeing on things you don't do, on things that you don't exploit, on things that you don't use up. And second, self-governance, the idea that you often find in post-growth work that there's certain skepticism towards the market as an intermediary, for sure, the mediator, but also the state. And so self-governance here would mean the idea of disintermediated everyday finance that early Bitcoin represents to a certain extent. And the self-limitation was manifesting itself in a token cap that still is for the original Bitcoin in place. But over time, interestingly, the principle of self-governance ruled so supreme that self-limitation almost went out of the window in many ways through the forking that the Bitcoin project saw. And so many other altcoins that are kind of in the spirit of Bitcoin emerged, but that didn't have token caps and were kind of more designed to be kind of classic speculative devices. And that's where the original post-growth idea or the post-growth seeds kind of didn't come to blossom in the ways that might have been anticipated.
You have explained you had already a couple of workshops leading towards the special issue. And we are now talking on the 20th of March, 2026, exactly 1 week after you had a last workshop in Groningen last Friday. talking about the metaphorical element in the room of all contemporary policy discussions. So there we are again with infrastructures, and you brought together discussions on roads, on ports, on rail as three major infrastructures. I would say let's go through them one by one with the post-growth in mind and then reflect a bit on what experience discussions you had on this workshop last week in Groningen, but maybe also connected to one, the ones that you had previously in 2024 and earlier. Roads are regularly seen as connected to resource demands, to pollution, greenhouse gas emissions, so all what you could call growth as such. But which tensions did actually surface in the workshop? How far can or should we rethink then road infrastructures?
Well, there's a piece on roads and the special issue by Eric Vesna and Cleo Zolpi on highways in the Brazilian Amazon. Also highway projects like unfinished roads, roads partly built or in the making. And they look at kind of different infrastructure imaginaries that are contestation with each other. And what I take from this, for me at least, in terms of rethinking roads, which was your question, is the point is not really to live in an entirely road-free world, but it's more to really critically look at the growth of roads, even in countries with dense road networks already, European countries are like this. And to reflect upon what other means of transport could be infrastructure, or could differently in terms of infrastructure. And of course, it also matters where roads are planned to be built or actually built. Eric McVay showed this. In certain ecosystems that are very pristine, it might be much more harmful to build them than in other places. So it's also about, when you come to a post-growth planning perspective, I think it's about making conscious decisions about what you build and what not you build. And if you actually build, you need where you do this and where you don't do it. Right? Post-growth, that actually resembles or kind of reflects this idea of self-limitation. Where do we as society collectively agree to not do things because we find them too harmful for us socially and ecologically, when we should combine social and ecological.
And then ports, second infrastructure. So ports are mostly the nodes of global trade and the entry point of oil, gas, minerals, consumer products. So the engines of growth, you could say. Notwithstanding that, they also cover large amounts of land. They transform wide landscapes from nature, agriculture, to lots of concrete, steel, lots of loss of biodiversity as well. If I have that in mind, how did the discussions about ports unfold when connecting to post-growth?
Yeah, like roads, we classified them under transportation infrastructures, which really speaks to the characteristics of all infrastructures as facilitating, but then the question is facilitating what? And of course, there's the commodities, there's the products you mentioned, but then the question is, you know, why, for whom? And at the workshop, the ports discussion of the paper by Asli Yuruk and Ozan Karaman was based on their article that really zooms in on the case of Galata Port in Istanbul, and that also kind of zooms out to situate that port in the kind of broader regional development strategies that are really grounded in growth. So the paper really nicely kind of maps literally the interconnections between Istanbul port and the broader Mediterranean port industry, as well as the aviation industry, where, as Asli was pointing out, that people fly into Istanbul and then begin this kind of westward cruise journeys where ships embark at similar ports across the region, unleash consumption, waste. And we know that this is, you know, completely unsustainable. But the nitty gritty of how the kind of various municipal planners in Istanbul with, you know, some of the unions all kind of contributed to enacting Galata Port was something that their paper unpacked with a lot of detail and helped kind of map how things might also be differently, how they could change potentially in the future.
Yeah, and that paper actually, we get a first flavor of how different researchers can think together. So in their papers already pointing towards the interconnection, different types of infrastructure.
A bit more diverse could be the picture on rails as a third type of infrastructure, as on the one side, rail is the backbone of heavy industries, also of polluting industries in history. On the other side, rail is also part of a transformation to sustainability, of a potential to be less harmful to the environment in terms of transport overall. So from your experiences, which promises can rail infrastructure really fulfill in a post-growth perspective, and where also then limitations in that.
A colleague of yours from Groningen, Zinka Modern Sunnyvale College, was contributing this Rails perspective. And I think the perspective is a little different, so I'm not sure I fully answer your question, Kristen, here, but I think the angle that Zinka was developing in this paper is looking critically into promises of high speed and connectivity and contrast them, juxtapose them with experiences of delay and disrepair. So this supposed high-speed rail connection in the Balkans connecting two different countries, if I remember correctly, never really came into existence in the way it was planned. It was never really fast and so on. And so I think there's also, for me, this raises two interconnected issues. And this is also in connection with other work in the special issue, specifically by Clemens Hoffmann, on the lure of rapid transformation speed. And also Dan Durand's contribution on the strive for mega projects. So the first one would be, it's really important to get the infrastructure mix right. That's not what I would take from these papers together. Trying to use as few resources as possible while ensuring connectivity and flow. That's a sufficiency perspective in a way. Don't just build for the sake of building more because it will boost growth. That's really not smart. And the post-growth planners would disagree that it's smart. And second is also, the infrastructures that we want from a social and an ecological perspective have to be maintained properly.
Well, that's coming.
And those that we do not want to maintain can be let to break down or to fall into disrepair. So the upshot is really that we need more political debate than we currently have about what kinds of infrastructures are required in the age of both ecological breakdown and social division. So coming at infrastructure from this angle is more fruitful than continuing to first think about how it might boost GDP or might not boost GDP.
There was a final part in the workshop that was a bit more unexpected to me when thinking from an infrastructure perspective, that was touching on accounting. If we talk about accounting now, can you take us into the discussion and which messages it brought forward? And in particular, what would be then crucial for future planners to learn and more to use? That you regularly don't talk too much about accounting as such.
Yeah, unexpected and unusual is where we want to go. I think post-growth studies could really benefit from looking at these kind of unusual spaces and places. Because at least in accounting, literally when it comes down to it, whether you know a project gets enacted or not, depends on P&L, so profit and loss. But how do we assess profit and loss? You know, which variables get included and which don't? So we know a fair bit from economics, you know, externalities get discounted or put outside models. And then, you know, the economics profession gives Nobel Memorial Prizes to creators of models like Nordhaus that say, 4 degrees of climate change is going to result in slight declines of GDP. So we know lots about that, but we don't know as much about kind of ecological accounting. And that's what the paper by Sylvain Machler and Valérie Boisvert emphasizes. So how we account for growth really lays the foundations for whether we can include different thinking, especially about the concept that they really unpacked, which is about materiality. So at the workshop, Sylvain gave a really nice accounting 101 prepper and was noting the kind of differences between what's material for investors, so financial materiality, what matters for like a company's bottom line, and materiality in the kind of broader socio-ecological sense. And what that paper brilliantly does is traces the kind of long evolution by different actors inside and outside the accounting profession to integrate various forms of materiality into the way that accounting is done. And there's this whole notion of double materiality that comes out of all this. So the importance of accounting is also clear in the paper by Catherine Furlong in the special issue that's on the pressure of financial debt and servicing provisions in the public sector. And here again, financial materiality kind of trumps other forms of materiality and super important to unpack in the case of Colombia.
Thank you. Yeah, some new perspectives also to think about after listening to this podcast episode and then taking the opportunity to getting into the special issue and reading about the several contributions and reading also about your editorial. I think that's the call to our listeners to do that. But before we now move to the very end of this episode, we usually finish everyone by asking you to finish the sentence post-growth planning is. And that's what I would now also ask you to do.
It's tasked with taking socio-material relations seriously, reflecting on acting on how their practices interact with increasingly digital objects. That's the long form one. And then Matt has a shorter one.
I try to be more provocative. Post-growth planning is myopic if it fails to see infrastructure.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Matt. Thanks a lot, Malcolm, for joining me today in this podcast. And all the best for your coming new projects. Is there one following the special issue?
I'm working on knowledge infrastructures at this point, which kind of tags along with the accounting one. So how do we account for things is very important. And if you situate that even larger in knowledge infrastructures, it becomes quite a daunting challenge. So how do we know that climate change exists? There's been a quite fruitful literature from science and technology studies on knowledge infrastructures that I'm building on for looking at the digital world in particular.
So without Malcolm, I think my infrastructure career is a bit poor. So I'm probably going back to more kind of conventional stuff that I've been doing and currently trying to understand better how my bigger project with colleagues in Essen, how international institutions might implicitly embrace post-growth ideas slightly, a little bit, without talking about it. So the idea is really to move beyond looking for whether they say post-growth ideas, but really looking for placeholders that could signify some seeds of post-growth again. I think that's maybe where it comes back to our joint project here. And for anything infrastructural, I will do it again with Marco. Thanks for having us.
Thanks
a lot again. And then good luck for your new individual and maybe potential future joint projects.